setting policy is the wrong approach, and one that should be pushed back.
Senator Murkowski prepares to fight a new EPA policy direction. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 8th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers consider overriding the governor's veto of Denali KidCare funds.
And I believe that now what we're seeing is politics playing out in a very ugly way in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Senator Lisa Murkowski and a dozen other Republican lawmakers in Washington gathered today before reporters to preview her plan to block the Environmental Protection Agency's regulation of greenhouse gases. Murkowski is introducing a disapproval resolution that would strip the EPA of its power to regulate carbon dioxide. It will be debated and voted on Thursday on the Senate floor. Even if Murkowski's plan gains traction in Congress, the Obama administration said today that the president's senior advisors will recommend he veto it. It says Murkowski's plan would undermine the Clean Air Act. But Murkowski said the EPA intends to take control of climate policy.
What you are seeing here by the EPA truly reaching into the legislative area and setting policy that we as elected members representing our respective constituencies across the country, is the wrong approach, and one that should be pushed back. And I think the vote that you will see on Thursday is one that speaks directly to that administrative overreach.
The EPA's finding that greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare allows it to make rules curbing greenhouse gas emissions. Defenders of the Obama administration point out that it was the Supreme Court that required the EPA to decide whether carbon dioxide is a threat to human health. When asked at her press conference, Murkowski didn't say whether she thought the courts had also overextended their reach into the work of Congress. So far, Murkowski's resolution has the support of 40 other senators, including 3 Democrats. It needs 51 votes to pass. Alaska's Democrat Mark Begich is one of the senators whose stance is being watched. But today he said Murkowski's resolution is not the way he'd choose to go.
The merits of us doing the more comprehensive approach, I agree with her on that. She thinks maybe EPA is going too far in the regulatory process. I don't disagree with that. I just have a different approach. I want a comprehensive energy plan.
Begich says while Congress should have the final role in setting policies regulating greenhouse gases, it should be as part of a larger energy and climate change bill.
This body has sat around for decades. They talk about it. They do special interest legislation, seems every year, to take care of their friends, while the American people are continuing to import oil from foreign countries that don't like us. We spend billions overseas, which we shouldn't be doing. And so my view is, after, again, a year and a half being here, sometimes you got to just keep things bubbling in order to get this body to get off their butt and do things.
Other Democrats say the EPA is not moving quickly to implement regulations surrounding greenhouse gas emissions, and so the concern is overblown. EPA head Lisa Jackson wrote a blistering response to Murkowski's resolution in yesterday's Huffington Post. She said it would increase America's oil dependence and said the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is a reminder of the hazards of America's oil addiction. Murkowski responded today by saying the administration had reached a new low by invoking the BP blowout in the debate over her resolution. Dozens of villages across Alaska and the YK Delta will soon see the presence of newly trained police officers. A new training academy taking place in Bethel is boasting the largest ever graduating class of village police officers. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
When the lone village public safety officer left the village of St. Mary's, Fred Lamont Jr. was hopeful that someone would quickly step in to patrol his village. And when no one did, He decided it might as well be him.
And no one else wants to do the job out there.
Lamont quit his job as a health aide and became a village police officer. He had no experience and no training, but he says the effect was evident from day one.
There's four particular houses just right across the street from me. Every other night, you're always hearing screaming, hollering, someone's drinking, going crazy someplace. Since I started parking the police car outside my house, it's been nice and quiet up there. So just having that presence there, knowing that there's someone that's going to go and get them if they're breaking the law, I guess it makes all the difference.
But Lamont says at times he felt overwhelmed and he knew he had a lot to learn. Unlike VPSOs, which are highly trained and funded by the state, village police officers are hired by villages or tribes. They are typically used where there is no other law enforcement or if a community wants a bolstered enforcement presence. And interest now seems to be on the rise. The VPO Training Academy held recently in Bethel graduated 37 students, the most ever, perhaps because the training is now taking place in the largest hub community in rural Alaska. Until recently, it was held in King Salmon. But when facilities at the Utlitnavit Training Center in Bethel opened up, organizers decided to run the training there. Trainer and VPSO, James Holscher.
Having it here in Bethel, where the majority of the people that are attending are from this region, from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, may have accounted for some of the increase in the class size.
This training is basically trying to simulate a high-stress situation.
VPSO and trainer Jacob Dubitluk says that once they leave the training, many VPOs will be on their own.
Once they walk in a door, someone could be yelling, someone could be screaming, someone could be hurt, really bad situation, like blood everywhere and whatnot. For someone who has no experience in, or never saw that before, they kind of panic. But when they're trained to do something and they walk into a oh crap moment, they fall back on their training.
Unexpected situations are becoming the norm for Daniel Joke of Nebuskiak. The 19-year-old is now the sole officer in the village where he grew up. That means he's not just learning how to police, but how to cope with his new responsibility.
I blocked a whole image about arresting my uncle, auntie, whatever they are to me, and know that I'm helping this person and that family because a lot of times there's kids involved.
Like other graduates, Joke will head home now as a graduated village police officer. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
A group of state lawmakers wants Governor Sean Parnell to call them back into special session so they can override his veto of a bill expanding access to Denali Kid Care. The program provides health care to low-income families. Last week, Parnell said he was vetoing the bill because the program funds medically necessary abortions. Senator Betty Davis, a Democrat from Anchorage, sponsored the bill.
And I have worked on this piece of legislation for 4 years, and here we are back where we started. But I want you to know, I'm not tired. I will continue to fight that battle.
The bill was meant to provide health care to 1,200 more kids in Alaska and 200 more pregnant women by increasing the income guidelines. When he announced the veto, Parnell said he was changing his mind on the expansion because he had recently learned Denali Kid Care funded some abortions. But lawmakers say he has known for more than a decade. Senator Hollis French, a Democrat from Anchorage, pointed to a transcript of an exchange Parnell had when he was a senator in 1998 and the Denali Kid Care bill was being considered for the first time.
Senator Parnell next referred to the pregnancy-related services and wanted to know if this bill, the Denali Kid Care bill, would expand eligibility for public funding of abortions. Ms. Perdue, she was then the commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, said the purpose of the bill was for prenatal care. Federal Medicaid laws prohibited the kind of funding for abortions that could occur to those allowed in the Hyde Amendment, which was basically for rape, incest, and the life of the mother, if the life of the mother were endangered. Therefore, under Medicaid, he was told itself, there were very limited situations where abortions could be performed.
Both Senator French and Parnell are campaigning for governor. French says Parnell is using the Denali Kid Care issue as part of the campaign.
He supported Senator Davis's bill all the way through the process, until the political season came upon us. And I believe that now what we're seeing is politics playing out in a very ugly way in Alaska.
Governor Parnell's spokesperson says he's traveling today and can't respond to the comments. She says he only recently discovered Denali KidCare funded abortions. She also says the governor has no intention of calling lawmakers into special session. French says he asked Senate President Gary Stevens to poll lawmakers to see if there is enough support for an override to call a special session on their own. Stevens told the Anchorage Daily News an override is unlikely. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the science behind a record-breaking pollen season in Alaska.
Pollen cycles are beginning earlier, and pollen cycles are tending to peak as far as high levels.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
There's no apparent relationship between a man who lived on Prince of Wales Island 10,300 years ago and present-day Southeast Alaska natives, but the connection may still be there, waiting to be discovered. The remains of the man known as Shuka Ka, or Man Ahead of Us, was found in On Your Knees Cave. Dr. Brian Kemp is a molecular anthropologist at Washington State University who uses genetics to research relationships of Indigenous American populations. He returned to Juneau during Celebration 2010 last week to explain his findings. Kemp says they were able to extract from Shuka Ka's tooth a sample of mitochondrial DNA. That's a smaller genetic sequence located outside of a cell's nucleus that's only passed on maternally.
So the genome is very large. There's lots of A, G, C's, and T's, 3 billion of them. A lot of those A, G, C's, and T's code for nothing. They don't affect the way we act, they don't affect the way we look. And we call this junk DNA. And it changes at a regular rate, and it has no effect on us. And we just accumulate changes over time and pass those on to our offspring. Now, the important thing about this junk DNA is that we bring our junk DNA everywhere we go.
Within that junk DNA are five different genetic patterns, or haplogroups, that Native Americans are believed to have brought with them from Asia. Shuka Ka had an extremely rare genetic pattern called haplogroup D. It's been traced to present-day natives in the Ohio River Valley, Southern California, Mexico, Ecuador, Peru, Brazil, and down to Chile and Argentina.
And so this pattern is very curious. About only 1.5% of Native Americans carry this type. Look at the pattern. The distribution is very Western, is very coastal. And I take this as evidence of an ancient coastal migration, right? Right down to Tierra del Fuego. This is a very interesting distribution of a lineage.
The actual period of the migration will be hard to determine until there are more samples. Kemp was in Juneau during Celebration 2008 when more than 230 volunteers had their DNA tested. None had Shuka Ka's extremely rare pattern. Kemp says there may be a few reasons for that.
There's chance in sampling. We did collect a lot of samples, but this type is very rare. So it's possible that we just missed it, but our sample size was very adequate. Now there's another component, chance over time. So 10,000 years is a very, very long time. I don't know that anybody has recorded continuity and genetic continuity over 10,000 years, because every generation, there's a chance, say, that the woman carrying that type has all sons. The irony is the man that died in the cave couldn't have passed on his genetic type because he's male. He had to have had a sister. If he didn't have a sister, then that type wouldn't be passed on. That's a possibility. 10,000 years offers a lot of chance to happen.
Kemp says that does not rule out any undiscovered relationships between Shuka Ka and present-day Southeast Alaska natives. A global mining company is beginning exploratory work at Groundhog Mountain near Lake Iliamna. KDLG's Adam Kane has more.
Most of the controversy about mining in the Bristol Bay region has been focused on the proposed Pebble Mine. However, the region around Iliamna Lake is thought to contain quite a few more mineral deposits than those found at Pebble. Last week, Kennecott Exploration Company held a presentation in Non-Dalton to discuss a possible project at Groundhog Mountain. Last Thursday's presentation included a number of people working on the Groundhog Mountain project, including exploration manager Russ Franklin. He says that if a large copper deposit is found, it will likely be very deep underground.
What our plan is to first come in with a first pass and use geophysical techniques to try to see something at depth. And it's kind of real cutting-edge stuff, and it's not a sure thing by any means whether we'll be able to even see anything.
Another of those who spoke Thursday afternoon was Rob Rutherford, who works with the Anchorage-based firm of Alaska Earth Sciences.
You sit on the edge of one of the most important mineral deposits that has ever been discovered in Alaska, perhaps in North America, and ultimately perhaps in the world.
Alaska Earth Sciences holds the mining claim for the Groundhog Mountain project, but they did not have the funding to explore the site. That resulted in a partnership being formed with Kennecott to conduct the exploration portion of the project. While the management of the Groundhog Mountain and Pebble projects are not the same, they do have a very close financial relationship. Global mining giant Rio Tinto, which owns Kennecott Exploration Company, also owns a nearly 20% stake in Northern Dynasty, and Northern Dynasty is a 50% partner in the Pebble Partnership. Jeske later clarified his statement after the presentation.
So Rio Tinto does have an investment interest in the Pebble project of less than 10%. So there is a relationship between our parent company and the Pebble mine, absolutely.
The Groundhog Mountain project is at a very early stage of exploration, and Jeske says that the company has no plans to drill this summer. One of those in attendance for last week's meeting was Clark's Point resident Alana Hurley, who works for Nunumpta Luxtai, which is a consortium of Alaska Native corporations opposed to mining in the Bristol Bay region. She questioned Matt Jeske about the concerns raised by the local residents of Non-Dalton.
Say you guys go through the process, you make a plan, but this community or communities around here say nothing's guaranteed. Maybe your plan will work, maybe it won't, but we don't want to risk it. Would you guys pick up and leave? Do you care that much about what these people feel? That you would pick up and leave after all this exploratory stuff if they said, we don't want to risk this?
We have done that.
Where?
In Australia.
Rio Tinto, which owns Kennecott Exploration Company, is currently operating 8 large copper mines and is considered to be the 4th largest mining company in the world. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
On Sunday, the nonprofit corporation that operates the huge sports dome in South Anchorage announced it had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Yesterday afternoon, Anchorage Sportsplex Incorporated was in court to begin setting up formal arrangements with its major creditors. KSKA's Len Anderson has more.
According to Alice Fedorenko, CEO of Anchorage Sportsplex, the dome, which opened in 2007, is well used.
We probably see fall and winter about 8,000 people a week in here.
In summer, that number drops considerably, but the overall yearly utilization, and thus revenues, have increased over the last couple of years, but not enough.
Since the dome began operations, we have operated at a deficit. Our long-term debt is much higher than the dome can sustain on a monthly or annual basis.
The dome originally cost $14 million. Fedorenko hopes a Chapter 11 arrangement can be finalized sometime in the fall. Another expense Anchorage Sportsplex wants to reduce involves property taxes. This year, that amounts to $216,000. Attorney David Bundy, who's handling the bankruptcy, says the property tax concerns are twofold.
It is a question of whether the dome is legally qualified as a charity and therefore exempt from taxes under court decisions. The other issue is how much is it worth for tax assessment purposes. That's a separate question whether it should be taxed at all. The value of the dome is debatable. The municipality has a high value, and we think it should be less.
Marty McGee is Anchorage's municipal assessor. While he could not speak to the Anchorage Sportsplex case, McGee could discuss in general terms nonprofit organizations and property tax exemptions.
The most common misconception is that because they qualify with the IRS as a not-for-profit status, they're automatically exempt. And that's not true for local property tax. We have a different set of criteria that's only one of the criteria to make them exempt.
Sportsplex hopes to gain a property tax exception within the nonprofit charity category through a court judgment. That appeal is currently in litigation. Fedorenko says community response since this weekend's announcement is encouraging. One soccer club plans to increase its summer use, and there's already been some unexpected individual summer memberships. The Sportsplex CEO says she hopes this situation leads to a broader awareness of whom the Dome serves.
We've seen an increase in users with disadvantaged capabilities. We've seen a lot more wheelchair use, people with three-wheel bikes come in, and I think a few more senior citizens than we'd seen in the past. I think it's just getting the word out that we're open to the public. We're not a club. We're here to serve the public.
The next hearing in the Sports Dome's Chapter 11 bankruptcy request takes place next month. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
A mountaineer from Belgium has died in a fall on Mount McKinley. The National Park Service says the accident occurred Monday afternoon on a highly technical section of the Cassine Ridge on North America's highest mountain. Park officials say 27-year-old Joris van Reeth of Borgerhout, Belgium, was leading the way when his climbing anchor likely failed and he fell about 100 feet in rocky terrain. Van Reeth fell to where his partner, 24-year-old Sam Van Brempt, was positioned. Van Brempt was not injured. After confirming that his climbing partner was dead, he used his satellite phone to call Denali National Park officials. The death is the second on McKinley this climbing season. A 51-year-old French climber died last month. It was a solid first weekend of dip netting at Chitna. State management biologist Mark Somerville says the few who headed down to the Copper River didn't limit out at 30 fish, but most did okay.
The samplers down there said that most people caught anywhere from 5 to 25 fish and figured there was anywhere, probably 100 people down there this weekend.
Somerville says sockeyes have been running on the larger side, likely due to strong components of 5-year-old fish in this year's run. He says the much lower volume King Run appears to be okay, with downstream harvest in the native village of Eak fish wheel slow, but better than last year. Salmon passage by the Miles Lake sonar was below projections the last week of May, prompting a suspension of commercial harvest on the Copper River Delta. Somerville says numbers have been picking up in recent days.
We're now up to about 25 to 27,000 fish per day through the sonar counter, and it's been building steadily for the last week. There were no commercial openers all of last week, so that probably adds to the fact that we're seeing so many fish coming through the counters.
Somerville says overall the Copper River salmon runs appear to be tracking 3 to 5 days behind preseason projections. Water levels remain relatively low for this time of year on the Copper River, but are expected to come up as warm weather returns. Alaska has seen record-breaking pollen counts this spring. After seeing billowing clouds of pollen over Sitka's hilltops, KCAW's Lily Mihalik spoke with Dr. Jeffrey DeMain, director of the Center for Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology of Alaska, to see what rising pollen counts and global climate change mean for Alaskans.
Nearly 4,000 grains of microscopic pollen per cubic meter might not sound like much. But when you consider 90 grains is classified as high, the equation changes. Pollen is released each spring, beginning around the third week of April and riding wind currents well into June. Still, DeMain said, it's not just the wind doing the work. Pollen is built to fly.
When you actually look at pollens, based on their weight and their physical design, some of them actually have little microscopic air bladders to allow them to travel very long distances. And the reason the pollens need to travel far is because it wants to populate, just like humans. I mean, we want to populate, and so do these plants.
And rising CO2 levels, said Demain, are helping.
As CO2, or carbon dioxide, levels go up, one of the principal greenhouse gases, pollens go up almost side by side. So we see that CO2 tends to increase pollen biomass, and it does that because, plants are carbon fixing. That carbon is necessary for photosynthesis.
Photosynthesis is integral to a plant's survival, as is pollination. And that's why trees, unlike flowering plants that rely mostly on insects to pollinate, have evolved to release pollen when temperatures are high and humidity is low. Perfect conditions for pollen flight. Rising temperatures and a drop in humidity over the last 30 years, said Demain, may play a part in the huge pollen cloud Sitkin saw rising over their spruce forest last month. And CO2 levels might also be responsible for a recent flare in allergies.
Pollen cycles are beginning earlier, and pollen cycles are tending to peak as far as high levels. What you experienced in Sitka, I suspect, paralleled what we were seeing more in south central, in the interior of Alaska, where we hit near world record levels. Tree pollens are considered very high if they're exceeding 1,500 grains per cubic meter. In Alaska, we hit specifically 3,986 grains per cubic meter, and that occurred on May 13th. So that was certainly the highest level ever recorded in Alaska, and we've been recording pollens for about 30 years. But when you have very high levels like that, it can also provoke people that aren't currently allergic to tree pollens to become allergic.
According to Demain, the impact of rising CO2 levels doesn't stop there.
Studies have shown that with rising CO2 and rising temperatures, we're seeing the pollens become more allergenic. So they're actually becoming more sensitizing and causing more symptoms. And that's because of an increase in a level of a specific protein in birch. So, we're seeing an increase in the amount of pollen. We're seeing an increase in the immunogenicity or how allergenic the pollen is. So, what can we do about that? I don't know.
Reporting from Sitka, this is Lily Mihalik.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Matt Miller in Juneau, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Lily Mihalik in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.